Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. On today's show, lawmakers voted down a number of taxes this week, but some know the issue isn't going away.
When we spend all our savings, that's when we're probably going to do something about it.
Figuring out just how hard Wyoming is getting hit by prescription opioid overdoses may be hard to track because of the stigma.
It's taken a long time for me to be able to say that it was drugs that killed my son. Now I think I do it because it really is time for people not to feel ashamed.
And a story about the difficulty of passing on family ranches and farms to the next generation.
We're trying to get it to the next generation or the next two generations intact.
All that and much more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. 10 months and $800,000 later, the Select Committee on School Finance Recalibration has completed its in-depth look at how Wyoming finances education. Consultants told lawmakers that the current school funding model works, but pointed out areas for improvement, and their upgrades came with a cost. But despite that recommendation to spend more, lawmakers are opting to spend less. Wyoming Public Radio's education reporter Tennessee Watson follows up.
This is the fourth time lawmakers have embarked on this process in the last 12 years, and each time the results are about the same. Wyoming's rugged and remote geography makes education expensive. There are small schools and big schools, rural schools and urban schools, and given that, the state does a good job of making sure kids clear from Casper to Claremont have access to a solid education. Here's APA Consulting presenting their findings to the committee.
Remember, we did an equity study and found that the system here is pretty equitable. So basically, whether you live in a wealthy or a poor region, you're going to be spending roughly the same on education.
But APA told lawmakers that Wyoming should increase salaries for teachers if they want to keep talent in the state, and they recommended stronger funding for at-risk students and English language learners. They also recommended a new way of calculating funding for small schools. Ultimately, the committee declined to create legislation from APA's recommended model for two main reasons. It's not so different from what the state already does, and because it costs more. By not following the recommendations, the committee favored saving the state money. And to further reduce costs, they charged the Wyoming Department of Education with improving spending guidelines for transportation and special education. But committee co-chair Albert Summers says there will still be lawmakers looking for further cuts.
Well, I think there'll still be a discussion about whether we're overfunding education, about whether we can afford it.
In fact, it came up the next day when the Revenue Committee met in Cheyenne. Some lawmakers expressed concern about generating more money for an education system they think is too expensive.
2015, we spent $16,000 per student. There are only four states in the union that spent more. So we're spending more than 45 other states in the union.
That's Sheridan Senator Dave Kinski. He says Wyoming's neighbor Idaho is spending roughly $10,000 less per student. Kinski says if Wyoming pays significantly more for education, it should see better results. He points to the 8th grade reading scores on the National Assessment of Educational Progress, also known as the NAEP.
Wyoming ranked 12th. The score was 269. Okay, Idaho ranked 14th, essentially the same score, just tenths or hundredths apart, 269.
On 8th grade reading, Wyoming does closely resemble its neighbors. But to take a deeper look at the data, on 8th grade math, as well as 4th grade math and reading, Wyoming is ahead of its neighbors and also the nation. So some push back and say Wyoming is getting its bang for its buck. Speaker of the House Steve Harshman says Idaho has equity issues, whereas the Wyoming Supreme Court requires Wyoming schools to receive equitable funding, and Wyoming's small and more remote schools are more expensive per student. So then, what exactly does Senator Kinski want as far as NAEP results?
You know, I'm not even going to answer that. That question just doesn't make any sense to me. Like, you want me to say I want 350 or something? I'm not going to say that.
While Kinski doesn't have a specific goal in mind, he says Superintendent Jillian Balow has a good plan for measuring educational outcomes. And her attitude about the state's progress is a little different.
If bang for the buck means that every student graduates from high school and is a success in life, then that's not something that we'll ever achieve. But if bang for the buck means that we are investing our money wisely in education and seeing results like we should statistically be seeing them, then we are getting our bang for the buck.
She says Wyoming's NAEP scores show improvement, but you have to look at multiple measures to really show Wyoming's progress, like the increasing graduation rates and ACT scores, and a recent rank as number one in the West and seventh in the nation when it comes to education quality. As lawmakers prepare for conversations about education during the 2018 budget session, it seems like consensus on what achieving a bang means still needs to be resolved. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
This week, after months of discussion, a legislative committee defeated a number of tax increase measures. The Joint Revenue Committee was hoping to find money to pay for a revenue shortfall that some thought could reach $1 billion. Then a funny thing happened over the summer. The revenue picture improved, just enough that taxes could be avoided. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports that while the outcome isn't unexpected, the state still lacks enough revenue to pay for its budget.
During the spring, it looked like lawmakers may have to pass their first major tax in almost 25 years. They embarked on options from raising property and sales taxes to considering some new tax ideas to the usual discussion about imposing sin taxes. Then the state revenue picture changed. Gillette Senator Jeff Wasserberger.
Our investments as a state are doing really well. Our oil production is up.
And suddenly, the deficit became less daunting. Wasserberger used to be worried that the legislature's $2 billion reserve fund would soon be wiped out.
2 years ago, I thought that we were going to burn through our LISRA account, our rainy day account, in 3 years' time. I don't believe that anymore. I think the rate of investment on our LISRA account is pretty much the same, and we know that we can take maybe even as much as $200 million out of that fund each year.
Wasserberger says that could last 10 years or more.
Put it on there. I owe you a quarter.
That's House Minority Leader Kathy Connolly, who made an unwise bet with a reporter last spring over whether or not the legislature would pass a significant tax measure. Two recent revenue reports showed that over half the short-term deficit could be made up due to improvements in the economy.
Once we saw that the revenue streams are up, that we can pay our bills tomorrow and not worry about, you know, schools opening in the fall, I'm not surprised. Disappointed, but not surprised.
Even though the Revenue Committee voted the measures down, the tax hikes probably would have failed the required two-thirds vote needed for introduction in the House of Representatives. Remember, this is an election year, and Connolly notes that taxes are tough for Republicans to support, even in the worst of times. Cheyenne Senator Affie Ellis says if you're going to raise taxes, you better have a very good reason. That was made clear to her when she ran for office and went door to door.
And you realize that families have plans for every dollar that comes into their house. And so if I'm going to tax those dollars, literally reach into people's pockets, I need to be able to look them in the eye and say, here's why these dollars are necessary and the government needs them more than you. And with education, I don't think we've gone through that process yet. I think I still have too many unanswered questions about how dollars are being spent.
Lots of people share Ellis's concern and believe they're still paying too many dollars outside of the classroom. But getting those numbers has been difficult. She says getting a firm handle on education needs to happen before taxes are seriously considered.
I think that that's got to be the first step because education is half of Wyoming's budget. We're talking about $1.5 billion.
Senate Revenue Chairman Ray Peterson says citizens always ask him why they aren't cutting more, but he says they have cut a lot. That's one reason he says finding new revenue eventually needs to happen, because as the recent fiscal report shows, energy revenue is projected to drop off again.
I'm still concerned as a revenue chairman of long-term solutions, our dependency on our minerals. The downturn is still, we're still in it.
And they aren't raising enough current revenue to pay for their budget. Wyoming Taxpayers Association Director Buck McVeigh says expanding the tax base is the key to raising more money. He says too many businesses are exempted from paying taxes. Sometimes that's from a deal to attract a business. And the other issue is many service or recreation businesses have never had to pay taxes. McVeigh says that means citizens will have to participate.
Well, what we're talking about is looking at broad-based measures so we can increase fairness among the taxpayers and get out from being so reliant on one industry.
Which will even out the boom and bust cycle. But when will they seriously consider these things? Senator Jeff Wasserberger of Gillette says he has an idea.
When we spend all our savings, that's when we're probably going to do something about it.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Next up, teaching computer science in Wyoming schools. And a scientist tackles the controversy over whether dinosaurs were warm or cold-blooded. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. As lawmakers are discussing whether to add computer science and computational thinking to the state educational curriculum, they're looking to Powell as an example. Powell is one of only five school districts teaching computer science in the state. Wyoming Public Radio's Camelia Kudelska takes a deeper dive into how their curriculum has developed and persisted through the years.
It's a Wednesday afternoon. A group of five teens are hanging around after school. They're tinkering with a frame of wires, brackets, and wheels. It's a robot, which they custom built themselves. This is the robotics club, and the students are adding final touches to their robot for an upcoming competition.
There's these grids on the side of the field.
High school junior Alan Merritt explains the task the robot must complete.
And each grid can hold 12 of these foam blocks. And the main objective of the game is to collect as many blocks as you can and stack them into the grid. And the more blocks, the more points you get.
Merritt has taken all of the computer science classes offered at Powell High School. He was exposed to robotics at a young age. Merritt says his favorite part is problem solving.
I think it's really fun to figure things out and solve problems, and you're always learning new things, and I really like that as well.
And for the Powell School District, that's just it. Robotics and computer science is more than just learning how to code and program. Zach Ops, the middle school computer science teacher, says it's about the mentality, the ability, and the confidence to continually attack a problem and not give up.
These kids are changed when they commit and come in and really work at this. Even if they realize, like, man, I hate that, they will leave with skills that even if they never write another morsel of software in their life, like, that they will use forever. And the district definitely has recognized that.
Powell High School first introduced basic computing classes in 1986. Teacher Terry Foley was fascinated by computers and technology and had a feeling these machines were going to change the world.
And I remember telling my students, you know, there's going to be a time when you won't write letters on paper anymore. You'll actually write to each other using electronic mail. And I remember they thought that was pretty funny.
And sure enough, he was right. So even with some initial pushback from faculty and administrators, Foley added a number of computer-related classes throughout the years, including programming, web design, and HTML classes. District Curriculum Coordinator R.J. Cost is proud of what they do.
We have robotics, we have computer science, we have web design. We try to offer as much as we can offer with the number of students that are interested.
But none of the classes are required. They're electives. Wyoming lawmakers are considering requiring computer science as part of the statewide curriculum. But Koss isn't sure that's the right way to go. He says adding more required classes equals less flexibility for the students.
I think younger years, developing like we are in the 3, 4, and 5 with the robotics and that is going to help. I think we've got to get the message out. More than requiring, it's making people knowledgeable of what in the world this is about and how we can make a difference in their lives.
Zach Ops, middle school computer science teacher, says whether it's required or not, he thinks exposure to computer science throughout all grades is important.
Requirement at the high school level isn't going to do it. They've already made up their mind, right? They're just going to be miserable for a semester or whatever and get it over with. And maybe a few kids would unearth an interest, but they're not going to develop a passion when they're 16 and 17.
House Education Committee Chairman David Northrup agrees computer science needs to become a way of thinking, but he wants it to be required because it's important to the state's future economy.
You could have a job that is in New York and you could actually sit at your house and do it instead, and so here in Wyoming, and have to maybe fly out two or three times.
Lawmakers, the governor, and others hope this will help diversify Wyoming's economy and keep young people in the state. Their point seems to ring true with Powell High School junior Alan Merritt, who sees computer science or engineering in his future.
I really like Wyoming. It would be great if I could stay here, but if I have to move somewhere else, I guess I would.
But for now, he's hoping his team's robot will stack the most blocks, at least enough to win state, to qualify for regionals, and eventually worlds. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudelska from the Center of the West in Cody.
In the world of paleontology, there's a debate over whether dinosaurs were warm or cold-blooded, and just how quickly they grew up. Dr. Michael Demick is a paleontologist at Adelphi University in New York. He spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen in anticipation of a talk he'll give on the University of Wyoming's campus about his research.
It's like the hidden side of paleontology. You always hear about these great discoveries, but you don't hear about the years of work that go into it. To getting them. I think most great fossil discoveries, you could trace them back, if you go far back enough, to not a scientist kind of blindly, you know, deciding, okay, I'm going to go to Wyoming and I'm going to go to this particular layer. Usually the historical roots of where we know fossils are go back to the people that are already living in the area. So ranchers, hunters, hikers, things like that, who will just be out and about and come across something, and then they'll notify the local museum or a college or something like that, and then we'll get clued in, right? So we would need an army to actually explore on our own. But luckily, you know, there's a really rich history, especially in Wyoming, of local families that have helped paleontologists now for generations.
You have a pretty active field season in northern Wyoming. So what kind of fossils do you look for?
I'm more interested in whole ecosystem reconstruction. So we picked a certain layer of rock that I specialize in, I guess, or I study particularly, and that's called the Cloverleaf Formation. It's really kind of vivid, striped purple and red and white formation you see all around Wyoming. And we basically look to reconstruct that whole ecosystem of that formation that it holds. And so we find not just dinosaurs, but we found mammal fossils and fish and plants and turtles in an effort to really understand what life was like at the time.
There's a debate in paleontology whether or not dinosaurs were warm or cold-blooded. What's your research led you to believe?
So far, what we found is the answer is a little bit both. That like today, big diverse groups of animals tend to have large, diverse metabolisms and growth strategies. So I think the public and even scientists to some degree can tend to think of dinosaurs as this one group, when really we're dealing with hundreds and hundreds of species that lived in all different environments across Earth for, tens and hundreds of millions of years. So they're diversity of growth rates and of metabolisms is reflected in that.
And I understand that that debate is a little bit contentious among paleontologists. Why is that?
I think it's contentious. It's because it's a new debate and it's an old debate. Since the naming of the word dinosaur, since the first recognition of the group, people have been trying to reconstruct how they grew and what their metabolism was like. Really breathe life into them. And in large part, that was pretty speculative in the beginning, I would say. And it's only recently, in the past couple of decades, that people have started coming up with rigorous quantitative ways to test these kinds of ideas.
Can you tell us about your upcoming talk in Laramie?
So my talk, it's going to focus on how we do these reconstructions that I've been telling you about. So you start with a dinosaur bone. In the end, how do you figure out was it warm-blooded or cold-blooded? How do you figure out how fast it grew, how long it lived, all those kinds of questions? And then what can we tell about bigger patterns in the history of life? Can we tell that, for example, is it true that when something evolves a larger body size, it accelerates that development, or does it just take longer to develop at the same rate? Are there any overarching patterns, or is it just random and depends on the ecology of the individual dinosaur? That's an open question that I'm seeking to answer.
And that actually reminds me of, you know, something I wanted to ask, sort of larger picture. You know, what are the implications of, you know, rethinking whether or not dinosaurs were warm or cold-blooded or how quickly they grew up?
I think what it does is it brings them into a sense of reality, or it lets them view lets us view them much more just as animals living today. So rather than treating them as some sort of alien, extinct, old life form that's totally different, we're really learning that they had a lot in common with some animals today. Most strongly the birds, which are just the group of dinosaurs that haven't gone extinct. They're the group of dinosaurs that's with us still today.
Well, Dr. Demick, thank you so much for your time.
All right, thanks. Great talking to you.
That was Dr. Michael Demick speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen. He'll be giving a talk on the University of Wyoming campus as part of the Darwin Day celebration, February 6th at 3 o'clock. We'll take a quick break, then hear how ranchers are making sure their land stays in the family and look at the extent of the opioid crisis in Wyoming. Next on Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Ranchers across the West, on average, are nearing the age of retirement. But passing a ranch or farm down the familial line isn't as easy as simply writing it into a will. Poor planning can mean losing your property entirely, leaving huge tracts of rural land to development or corporate agriculture. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports what it means for ranchers to prepare their livelihoods for the next generation.
Winds are gusting over 45 miles per hour on an overcast day at the Dunmire Ranch in southeast Wyoming. Black cows graze in the distance with wind turbines lined up on the horizon. At the center of the ranch, young colts are milling around the corral as Gator, a 14-year-old blind dog, guards the house where the owner, Les Dunmire, lives.
See, hey. Right.
I'm Les.
Nice to meet you.
Come on in.
Inside the house, Dunmire puts on his dirt-caked cowboy hat and shoes. His lifestyle goes back generations.
My dad had a ranch at Iron Mountain, Wyoming, and my granddad had a ranch in Sioux County, Nebraska.
When Dunmire bought the ranch 30 years ago, he only had a few hundred head of cattle. Now he owns over 100,000 acres and 1,800 head of cattle. But at 66, Dunmire is starting to take a step back from it all. He explains his retirement plans as we drive over winter country on his property.
I always tell people that I'm going to work as long as I can and then become a burden for my children. But seriously, as we get older, we do a little less. As we get older, we transfer more of the day-to-day operations of the ranch to our children.
Dunmire says he sees passing on land as the last responsibility of a rancher.
We're trying to get it to the next generation or the next two generations intact with the smallest amount of tax pain that we could possibly have.
Planning an estate transfer isn't easy. He's been dealing with it for 26 years. The process has required an accountant and lawyer to figure out, dividing the land into six legal entities to ease tax burdens. Years ago, his dad bought a ranch from a family who went through the worst-case scenario firsthand of poor estate planning.
There was kids that wanted to stay there, but when the grandfather passed away, he had not done any estate planning or gifting or anything to get ready to pass it on. And they had to sell the ranch, basically, because of the tax situation.
Dunmire is far from the only one going through this process. In 2012, the average age of farmers and ranchers hit a record high of 58 years old. According to a report from the National Young Farmers Coalition, 63% of farms are on the verge of transitioning. Experts say the U.S. needs to be prepared for a massive land transfer in the next decade. John Hewlett, a farm and ranch management specialist at the University of Wyoming, is one of many who are working to smooth that transition.
A lot of folks need help in terms of transferring ownership, worrying about how to best structure their farm or ranch in terms of tax, as well as making sure that the ownership is transferred such that the ranch or farm can be viable after the transfer.
Hewlett says easing the transition isn't just about helping the older generation, but the younger one too. That's increasingly tough, with fewer and fewer young people joining the industry. In 2012, only 6% of farmers and ranchers were under 35.
And so they become educated and they have other income-earning opportunities as a result. It's a lot different than in 50 years ago, where a lot of people's focus was to be on the land and to do some kind of a job on the farm. It was part of the family's activities.
Hewlett has helped create a website full of resources on steps to take in land succession. There are many other organizations as well, offering seminars, programs, and workshops, like the Plank Stewardship Initiative, University of Wyoming Extension, and the Western Landowners Alliance. Leslie Allen, executive director of the Western Landowners Alliance, says her organization wants to help lower the barriers to entry for young people by supporting policies like loan debt forgiveness programs for those weighed down by student debt.
As a nation, we need to be looking at policies and economic strategies to sustain these landscapes and make it possible for people to make a living in the rural West, to stay on that land, to raise families on that land, to stay in rural communities in a way that supports both agriculture and conservation values.
She says a football field worth of land is lost to development every 2.5 minutes in the West. And that's private land that supports wildlife, clean air and water, and biodiversity. Allison says beginning the process of land succession early is crucial to preserving ranches and farms, whether there's an obvious heir or not. And that starts by talking about it.
So simply raising awareness and encouraging people to have what can be pretty uncomfortable conversations initially, those conversations can actually become quite positive and transformative.
Back at the ranch, Dunmire drives his red truck through a running stream.
Yeah, this is 3 Mile Creek.
It gives way to an open field with hundreds of cows grazing. A few trot out of the way as the truck drives through. Les says he's loved raising a family on the ranch.
The family is intertwined with the ranch. And it's a great place to raise cattle and kids.
And he says he feels lucky to pass that on. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Later this month, the Wyoming legislature will be asked to consider a bill that will hopefully stabilize Wyoming's air service. Senate Vice President Michael Von Flatern is the main sponsor, and he joins me to explain the concept.
Well, right now, the state of Wyoming does a minimum revenue guarantee, which means when we call the airlines and sign a contract with them, we say if so many seats are filled and you get so much revenue, the state doesn't have to pay any. But if you are missing one person, one passenger, and so we'll make up that difference. So they set a baseline that they need X amount of dollars per flight. Now, if they get X, you know, they sell 2 or 3 or 5 seats more than what they need to run that airplane, then they take that profit and they go home. So what this does is sets up a council for 1 year to write the proposal. We'll go out for proposal from different carriers, Western States, SkyWest, whomever is interested in bidding on it. We'll say, how much do you want per hour for your airplane? They'll give us a number. will say, fine, you know, you'll service Riverton with one or two flights a day, whatever they're eligible for, round trips a day. And then they will fly there. And if we put one person on there, the state will pay the difference all the way to the rent on their airplane per hour. And if we put enough on there to pay that rent per hour, great. If we put one more person on there, we take the profit from that as a state. The state aeronautics will take the profit. So what we're going to do is start out with at least three communities, we believe, and we will rent. We'll go out for proposals to the different airlines. They'll tell us how much they want an hour. We'll look at the number of employments they've historically had in each community. And we'll say, fine, let's send three planes up to Gillette, two to Riverton, whatever that number is. And then they'll pass through all the revenue they get for flying you to Denver, which will be, you know, roughly $150 a passenger one way. We'll take all that revenue. We'll take the baggage fees. All that will be passed through to the state aeronautics. The passenger will notice no difference in how it operates. So that's basically the concept, is we're buying capacity by purchasing an hourly rent on the airplanes.
I know you have to run. Let me just ask two quick follow-ups. So what's this going to cost the state?
This will be up to appropriations through the request by the governor to set aside $15 million over the next 10 years. And that's the biggest single issue. That's the reason that Gillette would consider this project, because Gillette right now is not subsidized in their flights. But what we're going to do is sign a 10-year contract. So you can tell a new industry or an existing industry that wants to expand, and a new industry that's looking at your town, that for the next 10 years, they know that they can get on an airplane every morning and go to Denver, and they can come back every night. And that is the biggest single economic driver that we've identified yet, along with workforce training and broadband connectivity.
Your belief is this will certainly stabilize air service in the state.
Right, exactly, for the longevity of the contract.
Senator Von Flatern, always nice chatting with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Bob. I appreciate the time.
Last October, President Trump took the stage to declare a public health crisis.
As you all know from personal experience, families, communities, and citizens across our country are currently dealing with the worst drug crisis in American history.
Seven people an hour, the president said, are currently dying of opioid prescription drug overdoses in the United States. In Wyoming, many say that the problem isn't so severe here. As Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, though, that could be changing.
Cheyenne resident Penny Hunt knew her youngest son, JT, wasn't like other kids. As lovable and creative as he was,
he grew up kind of as the daredevil, and I always worried about him.
JT struggled with anxiety. By the time he was 14, he was addicted to his prescription medication. At 15, he went to his first stint in an out-of-state rehab center.
He got out of rehab, was doing better, and had a wisdom tooth pulled, and was given pain meds, and then the cycle started over again.
When JT went back to get more teeth removed,
I asked the dentist if I could talk to him in his office, and I said, my son is an addict, you cannot give him addictive medicine. And he said to me, I signed an oath that I cannot let my patients leave in pain. And I said, then give him Tylenol.
Hunt said she left frustrated that the dentist didn't see the problem of prescribing to an addict. Still, her son found ways to get pain pills. Again, Hunt started making calls to rehab centers. She was no novice. She'd spent her entire career working in the healthcare system, but that didn't open doors.
And I kept being told over and over again, 3 months, 6 months, we can't get him in. We can do an assessment, but we can't take him. If you know anything about addiction, if you have someone who's willing to get help right now, things need to move right now.
These wait lists are no surprise, since Wyoming has only 8 residential rehab centers. Finally, she found a bed for her son in South Dakota. When he got out this time, she thought he might be getting better. Then, he didn't call for 3 days. When the police broke into his apartment, JT lay dead on his couch, overdosed on opioid prescription meds at 23 years old. That was 10 years ago, But Hunt says her experience with uneducated medical providers and a lack of rehab space still needs to be addressed in Wyoming. Research scientist Rodney Wambeam at the Wyoming Survey and Analysis Center is working on a study of opioid addiction in the state. He says, yes, Wyoming is seeing a rise in opioid addiction and overdoses.
We do have a problem. I think it's just not the crisis that you are seeing in other parts of the country.
Back in 2004, only 19 people overdosed on opioids in Wyoming. 10 years later, it had ballooned to 96. But Wambeam says other coal mining states have it much worse.
Compared to, say, rural Appalachia, where the people lose their jobs and coal mines have shut down and they stay, and they have a culture of despair.
Here in Wyoming, when energy workers lost their jobs, they left the state, so it's hard to know if they developed addictions or not. But Wambeam says now that Wyoming is monitoring opioid use, more medical providers are scaling back how much they prescribe. The goal is to get proactive before things get worse. A Wyoming health expert agrees that Wyoming's opioid problem isn't at crisis levels. Erica Matthews is the Wyoming Health Department's Substance Abuse Prevention Manager. She says her office started fighting the problem early. Now, every county has a prevention coalition, and every first responder has access to naloxone. That's a medication to stop an overdose in its tracks. But in a rural state, the challenge is getting people to those services.
I mean, you've talked about the frontier nature, and that is one of our biggest challenges, and the lack of supports that we do have in the state, but we do have other supports in other ways. We are such close-knit communities that we are able to make grand changes in those communities in a much shorter period of time.
But Matthews admits Wyoming does need to collect more accurate data from coroners and hospitals.
Really trying to drill down into like the hospital discharge data instead of just having it say prescription overdose. What was the prescription? Can we figure that out? So there are barriers, but we are working to tear those down and be able to get the data needed.
And some of that data includes the cause of death. For years, Penny Hunt kept her son's true cause of death a secret. The autopsy called it bronchopneumonia. She says lots of people do the same. And that's why Wyoming's data on opioid deaths may be inaccurate.
It's coming, and it's here. And Wyoming is really good at, you know, keeping our family things to ourselves and not talking about it. And so it's here. It's not being talked about.
In hopes of removing that stigma, Hunt's oldest son started an interactive map called Celebrating Lost Loved Ones, where families can post photos and share stories. JT's young, handsome face, just one of hundreds that have been posted there. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Coming up in our last segment, we'll hear the debate about how to best deal with all the dead trees left by the pine bark beetle. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. When you look at the Medicine Bow National Forest in southern Wyoming, you see patches of brown, casualties of bark beetles, bugs that kill trees. Even though it's been over 5 years since the epidemic peaked, the forest is still full of these dead trees. The Forest Service has created a proposal to help clean up these areas more efficiently. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Alana Elder reports, not everyone agrees on how to do that.
We're the opponents out here, so you see that first.
Joy and Dwayne Cowan are greeting people as they walk into the Forest Service's open house in Laramie. They've set up a card table outside the building and weighted stacks of pamphlets with rocks to cope with the wind. Their mission is to get people to oppose the Landscape Vegetation Analysis, or LAVA, a project that will enable the Forest Service to cut, thin, or burn up to 360,000 acres of forest land over 10 to 15 years. Dwayne Cowan is so vehemently opposed to that idea that he says the cause brought him out of retirement. But he tells me it's not that he's against logging.
I logged in this forest. I worked for the Forest Service. I could saw logs, and I went up there and worked 12 hours a day for 3 months, and I got out of debt.
Both Cowans are retired scientists, teachers, and conservationists. Their problem with this project is that they think the area slated for treatment is too big, with too much uncertainty. Dwayne Cowan says the same goes for the roads the Forest Service will have to build to get to all of those trees.
We're especially disturbed
with 600 miles of road, and they're asking us to okay that without even knowing where they're going to be.
The roads in the proposal would be temporary. The Forest Service would close them once the work was finished. But Cowan says, in his experience, there are no guarantees they'll be able to recover roads that are big enough for trucks. There's a lot the Cowans and other conservationists don't like about what's happening. It started this past summer when there was a public meeting the Cowans didn't hear about. They said the agency didn't do enough to notify people and started a petition to get the Forest Service to take a step back. But the whole point of the lava project is that the Forest Service is trying to work more quickly to clear beetle kill out of parts of the forest. For their part, officials from the agency say they did notify the public about the summer meeting. Tonight, they've invited people to what they're calling a public check-in. Inside, it looks like a science fair, with local officials poised in front of poster boards and people shuffling around the room. There's a decent turnout. Tony Hawk of the Laramie River Conservation District is helping explain the lava project to visitors.
The crux of it is that chart right there. Mm-hmm. 95,000 acres that could be clear cut, 165,000 could be selectively thinned, and then the last 100,000 could be things like prescribed fire.
There are several reasons the Forest Service wants to do something about beetle kill trees and fast. District Ranger Frank Romero says they can sometimes be used for timber, but
we have a short window for the marketability of utilizing the logs that we have right now.
Fire is another concern.
It can come through and burn down all this dead and down material.
And water infrastructure is another reason the Forest Service says they need to do more work in the forest. Cheyenne gets its drinking water from two reservoirs in the National Forest, and water managers worry that a fire would leave soil exposed, freeing up sediment to erode dams and clog pipes. The Laramie River Conservation District's Hawk, who was presenting to visitors earlier, says what he's heard from most people is that they just want to see something done.
As someone who recreates up there, you can't even move around.
Dr. Daniel Tinker is a University of Wyoming botanist who researches fire and disease ecology in the Medicine Bow National Forest. He can understand why people would look at a messy forest with dead trees and worry, but his research has taught him that widespread cutting or thinning isn't necessary.
I think the forests are pretty resilient already. We're getting a lot more other species, conifer species, subalpine fir and Engelmann spruce and aspen even coming in. So the stands themselves, some of them, not all of them, but many of them are becoming a lot more diverse in their composition.
More diversity means the forest has a better chance of withstanding a future beetle outbreak. And when it comes to fire studies, they haven't consistently shown that beetle kill leads to more severe fires. When trees are in red stage and covered in those explosive-looking needles, it's true. But when they're dead standing or fallen,
there's far from agreement.
He tells me about a review paper he read recently, which went through 40 studies trying to understand how beetle kill impacts fire risk.
It's pretty much stand by stand and study by study, and the results are pretty diverse.
Tinker says he supports removing threats to human health and safety, trees that are swinging dangerously close to power lines or increasing fire risk near homes. The Forest Service has been doing a lot of that. But he's not sold on the lava project.
A little concerned about trying to treat that many acres and not sure from reading the document that the science is behind a lot of the reasons that I'm reading for why they want to do the treatments.
The Forest Service plans to release its draft environmental impact statement for the lava project in May. Agency officials say that document will have more details on what they plan to do. At that point, Dr. Tinker, the Cowans, conservationists, and those in favor of the plan will all have another opportunity to give official comment. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Alana Elder.
Changing gears, the second season of the University of Wyoming's cultural series gets underway next week. Janelle Fletcher is the director of UW Presents, and she joins me now.
Well, Janelle, first off, welcome back to our program. We talked with you last fall about some of the events that were coming up in the fall and winter, and now we transition into winter, spring, and we kick things off with an amazing event. Why don't you go ahead and tell us about what's coming up next week?
We have the Peking Acrobats coming to Laramie on the 6th of February. That's next Tuesday. It's a really rare opportunity. They're normally a very expensive evening and unaffordable, but they happen to have a hole in their schedule. So they will stop in Laramie and do an evening of sort of high-flying, chair-stacking, death-defying, don't-try-this-at-home program opportunities that people can come and see, and it's a really great show for families.
Yeah, I want you to just talk a little bit about them because you've got some great events coming up this spring, but this is an amazing one to kick it off. I think you've understated from the videos I've seen. This is pretty impressive.
Yeah. For example, there's one bit that I believe they're scheduled to do in Laramie where they stack four bottles on top of a table. And on top of the four bottles, they'll stack a chair and they'll go chair upon chair upon chair until they have about 10. And there is a gentleman that'll sit, or actually sit if we count him being on his hands, but he'll be upside down on one chair that's askew, and he'll do all manner of sort of physical acts that are really impressive when you are on solid ground, let alone stacked on top of a chair stack and on top of bottles on top of a table. So it's really quite crazy. They're bringing contortionists with them, and so there will be contortion acts and all manner of other things that we don't even know how to describe, actually. So,
and there is videos, if you kind of look these guys up, you can see sort of what they're doing out there.
YouTube is full of videos of their program. I guess, you know, we kind of look at them as stunts in a way, but YouTube is full of videos of the acrobats, yes.
And we're not wrong. If you go online and you see anything that says the 10th, that was the original date. They moved you up a little bit to the 6th, which is okay. We just want to make sure people don't miss the event and they actually show up.
Yes, that is correct. Their agent, there was a little bit of a scheduling snafu, and so we got bumped to a Tuesday. So come Tuesday the 6th, they will not be here. They'll be in Durango, Colorado on the 10th. So.
Now, let's talk about just 10 days after that, you've got a very young and sensational pianist coming here. Tell us about her.
Yeah, Daniela Liebman is 16, which is crazy. She has a full performing career at the age of 16. She actually premiered with her first major symphony orchestra at the age of 8. So I guess she's, more than half of her life been doing this professionally. She is one of Mexico's cultural ambassadors, which is really great, and she will come here and do a solo recital. So it is amazing to see someone that age with that technical prowess, but also has a lot of artistic gifts as well. And those two things don't always marry at that stage in a career. So
what kind of things will she be playing?
You know, we don't have her program yet, but my understanding is it will be a sampling of what a standard classical piano recital repertoire would be. So some early, middle, late sort of composers, probably nothing crazy contemporary.
Last year, you had a sensational jazz program, and I think you're trying to at least equal or top that this year. That's coming up, the Bad Plus, on March 22nd.
Yeah, I think we actually topped it. We got really lucky. Most people know the Bad Plus for how they actually got famous, which was doing jazz covers of famous pop tunes and rock tunes. They still do that. They just released another album, which the title escapes me, but they got famous, you know, covering Sting and The Police and all manner of rock groups in a jazz style. And they just got a new pianist, and our jazz faculty are very excited. So,
well, I have a former jazz performer, he still performs on the side in my newsroom, who is excited to see the Bad Plus. So if you're into jazz, this is one you want to go to.
Yeah, these guys are top notch, and it's a really rare opportunity. Again, we got lucky. They're crossing the country, and they happen to have a hole for us. So they're popping on in.
Yep. Here's one you might want to act quickly on. This is Colin Mockery and Brad Sherwood, called Scared Scriptless. I am hearing lots of folks who want to attend this on April 6th.
Yeah, tickets are selling quickly. Colin and Brad got famous on Whose Line Is It Anyway, which with Drew Carey. I think that's how most people would recognize their faces. They were in Laramie some years ago, and that show sold out. We're expecting the same thing, so we encourage people not to wait. And they come and do an evening of improvisational comedy. They take suggestions from the audience. They bring audience members to the stage, so people should be prepared for that. And they do all manner of acts, including, you know, a bunch of shenanigans that include mousetraps.
And then on somebody famous's birthday on April 27th, the Lysander Piano Trio will be coming here.
They will. They'll actually first perform on the 26th with the University of Wyoming Symphony Orchestra. They'll do the Beethoven Triple, and then they will do a recital on the 27th of traditional piano trio repertoire. Again, I've not received their program yet, but they are competition winners for the Concert Artists Guild National Competition. So they are top-notch, and it's been a very long time since we've welcomed a piano trio to the stage.
How do we get tickets for all of this?
The Performing Arts box office is the best way to do that. The phone number is 307-766-6666. It's an easy one to remember. Or online at uio.edu/finearts.
Janelle Fletcher, thank you for battling through this cold and chatting with us today, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks so much for joining us for this episode of Open Spaces. Don't worry if you missed a story. You can find them all at our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
There you can also find links to our podcast, and it's available on iTunes. Anna Rader is our web editor.
We also invite you to visit us on Facebook, and all of our reporters can be found on Twitter.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.